Accession number 18474, Reel 2.
John Dyer, Reel 2. I just asked you if you were fed properly in Korea.
Young men of that age and never have adequate food. We're always sort of striving, saying we're always hungry. But we survived on, first off, on British compo rations, which were brought up from base echelon in hay boxes or like large box thermoses to keep the food warm. The only trouble was that with the cold, as soon as the food was dished out and put into our mess tins, it froze. So basically we had to have fires going to keep the food warm and basically eat it that way. Then after that we went on to American sea rations, which were packs, 48-hour or 24-hour packs for each man, and each man had his own box of rations. It was small, well, not small, sort of like half-baked bean tins, if I can explain the size, and each one contained a different meal. Some we liked, some we didn't, but and there was always enough. There was the meals in there with a sweet, chocolate biscuit, tin of fruit. A nice little tin opener was always provided with it. It was even down if you required it, toilet paper. It was all in this pack of food. And though they were concentrated foods, they were, yes, they kept you from being hungry. They really supplied the need. So that was our main food. The only thing that we did really miss was bread. We had compo biscuits, we had various things, but bread. And it wasn't until we'd been in Korea till the spring of Korea that we actually had bread. And that actually came off of the ships offshore. They started, their first bread came from them until bakehouses were set up, but their first bread came off the ships. I don't know which one, but we were very grateful to have a taste of bread. That seems rather sort of simple now, doesn't it, to think that a slice of bread was treated as a relish. But that's how we enjoyed our first slices of bread.
Did you get tobacco and drink issued?
Oh, yes. There was being, as I said, in a transferred to an Irish regiment, Gallagher supplied supplied us with, I can't remember. I know they came in 50 tins and it came spasmodically, but it was nothing to get several tins of these every time they came up. I think it worked out. We were on sort of like about 150 Gallagher's cigarettes in sealed tins. It was rather fortunate for myself, being a non-smoker. These provided a wonderful trade. I could trade my cigarettes for chocolate. I had I'm afraid I still have to have a trade for chocolate. I had a fancy that I like my chocolate, and so I used to trade cigarettes in for chocolate and various other items. So it served me purpose. And a drink, well, there wasn't a great deal of that came up. Once the weather eased and trucks could move more easily, naffy wagons used to come up occasionally, and then we could, those that required it, had their beer. Myself, I wasn't, though I did take to drink a little bit while I was out there. No, I wasn't a great drinking man, so we did get an issue of beer occasionally. That was also another trading subject. My best thing that I ever had while I was out there, I had my 21st birthday on on Gloucester Hill. That was after the Battle of the Imjin when we retraced our steps back up there. And I don't know how the commanding officer knew, but he discovered it was my 21st birthday, and my present was a case of 24 cans. I was very popular that day.
Now, if we can just go back to the narrative, because you were still going up to join the Ulster Rifles, can you tell me where and how you joined them, please?
That is, I'm afraid, the years have lost it there. I can't remember where we joined it. I know it was on a river. It wasn't the main river through Seoul. It was a small tributary that we were on, and we were sent up to guard a bridge. And we were sort of not billeted because we didn't live in billets. My whole time out there, I was under the stars the whole time. But there was a small farm to the one side, which obviously housed signals and HQ, but we were basically distributed along the embankment of the... I should imagine it was a canal, because there was a high embankment where it was. And during my first night up there, we kept hearing these cracking noises. Rather frightening, because I thought perhaps it was the Chinese walking across the ice on the river. But it wasn't, and one of the lads that had been up there some while before us, he proved that it wasn't, because he went down onto the river and jumped on the ice to show us that it wasn't that was cracking. It was actually what was happening was the water was shrinking from underneath the ice, and the ice was just cracking that way. But that was my first harrowing experience out there. It was a funny thing, really, because we had no shelter, so we all sort of got up underneath the banks of this embankment to keep out of the wind. And the next morning, it was funny, the whole side of the bank looked like a graveyard. There was just heaps of snow, and all of a sudden an arm would come out from one and a head from the other. During the night, there had been a lovely snowstorm, and we were sort of buried under 6 inches of snow. You wonder today now how we really didn't suffer more frostbite than what we did, really. That was my second night in Korea. My first night in Korea has a more human attitude to it. We stopped in a small village. Villages in Korea, houses in Korea, especially in the country, they had thatched roofs, and the walls were made of wattle and dab, so they were really sort of, I suppose you would say, ancient, really. But that's the way. It was all built from natural materials of the area. Anyway, we stopped at this place on the first night. I discovered afterwards that it was base HQ, but not really worrying about too much where we were. There was a sort of like a shelter. It must have been a stockyard at some time. It had a roof and several poles going around it. And as we were that far behind the line, we were allowed to have a fire to keep warm. Anyway, we're all sort of crouched around it, trying to pass the night away, half sleeping, half awake. And a group of Koreans came close, and they asked if they might stay the night. They were asked why, because all the others were still walking by, and apparently one of the ladies was expecting a child. Can we stop for a minute, please? What happened was that they asked if they might stay the night. What a coincidence. during the night she had her child. We didn't know nothing about it because we'd all moved discreetly away. And by the morning, they'd all gone. They'd moved off. One wonders, you know, what it was all about, really. These, how they picked the people that really suffer in wars. Okay, the troops get shot at, they get killed, they get injured. I mean, even though we were national servicemen, we were called up to do a duty. The civilians, they all suffered. No matter really what war it was in, you can take it from beginning of time right up to the present day. It's always the civilian that seemed to suffer the most. I mean, what did they have to... They were losing everything. They'd lost their homes, they'd lost their... They'd lost the will to live. It was nothing to see whole families, well, not whole families, but the grandparents, probably, and the small children. They were literally, it was so cold, they were so hungry, that they just sat on the road and literally froze to death. It was quite a harrowing experience, really, to somebody come from, shall we say, a civilized country, come from the West. And we had everything. And to see the way that these people live, okay, maybe it was their way of life, but not to the extent to be thrown out of their homes, thrown out of their villages, and to spend and their lives and to finish in that way. It really makes one think a great deal. It was particularly sort of harrowing to me. My life prior to that was, I was brought up in a nonconformist home, chapel, church, streets, chapel three times a week, twice in the week, and from sort of, not religiously, but Christianly brought up, and then thrown from one extreme to the other. It was very difficult to accept. And you ask the question, why? It was, most troops will do this anywhere. Why are we here? Why is it happening? Will we ever know the answer? Why? There's so many reasons why. But the main thing that struck me the whole time that I was in Korea was basically how these people were treated. And I suppose you could say man's inhumanity to man. The way that things went. I mean, not being a prisoner of war, I was very lucky. I did. Really, well, if we get time, we'll perhaps talk about that later on, but I was rather lucky to escape. And but the way that, no doubt that it's been recorded, the way that the prisoners happened, the way that they were treated, it's how can one man or one person treat another person in the same way. Wonders, and it's a thing that tested, and I'm afraid I was apt to let go, was your Christian attitude, your relationship between one man and another. on my return home, I became a lay preacher, and I tried to convince people of this. And somehow people didn't really understand, or they didn't want to know. And yet today we get the immediate reaction, don't we, from TV of what is going on in the world. Perhaps that was the trouble with Korea. You only had newsreels, and it took so long for them to get home, whereas today news is immediate. We've seen it in Bosnia, we've seen it in all the campaigns. It's immediate, it's into your home straight away. But it's still there, isn't it? Man's not accepting another man's way of life. Shall we change the subject?
Well, if we can pick up the narrative, you've spent your first couple of nights with the Ulsters. Can you remember what then happened? Were you still in the same place for a long time?
No, we were. It was at the time of the mobile war. We were on the move. We'd spend a few nights in a place. You can't say get dug in, because you couldn't get dug in. The ground was frozen so hard that you sort of just found, try and build yourself up a means of defence with rocks or timber or anything you could find. This was at the time when the war was motif. We hadn't gone static. And from there we were moved. Because what had happened by the time that we got there, on the first advance through Korea, it was done basically from transport, from roads, and everybody sort of whizzed up the roads and travelled north. The advance was too quick. The second time that we went up, it was decided that, because what happened was the Chinese would just disappear up a hill, hide in a cave, wait till everybody gone, and then pop out from behind them and cause chaos. So it was decided then that we had to go over the mountains. Every bit of ground had to be covered, and that's what we were doing. Hopping from one mountain top, you'd climb up one mountain one day, spend a couple of days out there, down into the valley, and up again the next day, and so it went on. Most of the movement was done at night, hoping that they wouldn't know where they were, but I think they knew where we were if we didn't know where we were. But that was what it was done, and that is why the second advance up through Korea was so much slower. Every piece of ground had to be checked out, every cave had to be checked out, everything had to be checked. And so we went on and up and up onto the Imjin River, 29 Brigade. Well, the Ulster Rifles actually had the first job of crossing the River Imjin, and we crossed over and took a position on the far side of the Imjin, and the Norfolks and the Gloucesters stayed on this side of the Imjin, both sides of the road, the main route from the north down through to Seoul. We stayed over the river for a month or so. We actually started to dig in positions there. It's the first time that we really had a proper slit trench and means of defence. The Belgians were then attached to us. They came through and took over our position. We, the Ulster Rifles, when I say we, the Ulster Rifles, were brought back into reserve. So if you can imagine a triangle, the Belgians in the front, Norfolks facing north, the Norfolks on the left, Gloucesters on the right, and we were tucked in behind.
The Northumberlands?
Northumberlands, yes, sorry, I do apologise, got that wrong. Norfolks to the left, Gloucesters to the right, and we were in reserve. We've been in reserve 48 hours, might have been less, just enough to wash your socks and have a bit of a change. And the Korean Spring Offensive started. The Belgians were temporarily cut off on the other side of the river, and the Korean hordes come charging through. The Battle of the Imjin had started.
Was this the Koreans or the Chinese?
The Chinese and the Koreans were on this offensive. This was the main offensive when the Chinese came into the war and really came through in their multitudes. Because up till then, the Chinese were there, but they were basically as advisories. It is believed that it was also communist controlled, obviously, so the Russians were there as well as advisories. But then again, the Americans were advisors and probably still are to the Koreans. So, and that was the start of the Imjin battle. Poor old Gloucesters, they've got a fair old thumping. So what happened was the breakthrough came through. The Ulster Rifles were then pushed in to cover a defence of what two battalions were covering. We held it overnight, but we could do no more because we were totally surrounded. We'd run out of ammunition, we had nothing left. So then air order was given to take an orderly retreat. We went back onto the next range of hills, hoping to check the flow after we'd been resupplied, but it didn't work. And then the general was order was given, every man for himself. Without going into too much detail, really, goodness knows where all these Chinese men came from. It's been recorded and reported lots of times, but when you actually see it, it took us 3 weeks to lay a minefield. It took them about 5 minutes to destroy it. I mean, they just literally used patrols of men. They just send in a small group to clear it. That didn't work. They send in a few more, and they keep going until the minefield. They wouldn't actually send their fighting troops through until the minefield had been cleared by human waves. They got through. And of course, the amount of, even after that, the amount of Chinese troops that came through. I mean, we were coming out of Closter Valley. We were actually on the hillside, on the banks on the other side of the valley, and it was literally covered with men. They were running, not hither thither. No, they were running straight for us and straight down the valley. They cut us off once, and they were intending to cut us off again. Unfortunately, they achieved it with many of them, but some of us were lucky enough to escape. I actually came out of the valley on the back of a tank. The backs of the tanks were basically kept for the wounded. We'd already loaded up the backs of the tanks with the wounded to try and get them out. And there was one tank there with nobody on. And so we just took the chance and took a ride on it. We were told that there was a chance that we wouldn't get through. We'd be safer going up the hills. But anyway, two or three of us took the chance and climbed up on the back of the tank. And out we came. But the Chinese were still running alongside the tanks, throwing grenades onto the tanks, trying to disable them. I mean, we couldn't do a lot about it because we never had nothing left. We just laid there, quiet, still, and watching them well, or listening to them, being actually crushed by the tank tracks. Anyway, night time fell, and we were carried out. As we came out, we were taken up to an Indian field ambulance. The injured were lifted off, and we were hoping to go back with the Hussars back to BHQ. No such luck. I'm afraid they were rearmed and sent back to stop another outbreak. So the half a dozen of us were stuck at the field ambulance place. Obviously they didn't want us hanging about there, so we attempted to find our way back. The crux of that story was that my parents had a telegram, and to say I was missing, but it wasn't, and caused a bit of controversy at home. Anyway, after 4 days, we managed to find our unit. That was the biggest problem, was finding them, because nobody seemed to know where they were. We were all mixed, muddled up, different units and everything. Anyway, we did find them after 3 days, and we were allowed then to send another telegram home to say we were all right. And that was my part of the, or a small part of my part of the Indian battle. After that, we reached...
Which platoon and company were you in?
I was in C Company. 7 platoons and 3 section of 7 platoon. Our corporal in the Indian battle actually got took prisoner.
What was the leadership in your unit like?
It was very good. It was very good. We had two commanding officers, well, company commanders, but yes, they were all very good. They were all regulars, and they'd seen service in various campaigns, and they knew how to deal with us and help us through. Yeah, they were very good. They only sent us out on expeditions when they were ordered to. Because very often we were sent out on night patrols. I'm afraid that was one of the inconveniences of being a non-smoker. You were sent out on night patrols because you could actually smell the cigarettes of the North Koreans. They smoked a rather strong tobacco, which they were apt to do most of the time, and you could, as long as they were upwind of you, you knew exactly where they were. And we knew where we went at night patrols to find them. We could find them quite easily. The only advantage of a night patrol is that you were allowed to have the day off afterwards. But not that it made a lot of difference. But anyway.
How frightening was the Battle of the Imjin for you?